should get off this earth and move on to the space plane. Dimension number 3 and number 4 turns days into weeks. I'm talking about time. I can't say time cause it brings me down, and it's all too fast to slow. I got to change to number 5, then I might have some control in a space plane.
CKUT for a buffet of McGill musical talent, November 8th at Gertz Bar. Start off the night with the sweet sounds of Sarah Cryer. And finish it off with the earful of Societal Siege. Doors are at 6:30, show starts at 7, admission is free. Bring your audio appetite.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
Airing first on Asheville FM, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio show broadcasting out of occupied Cherokee land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world. Today we have a two-part show. In the first part, we are presenting a conversation with someone from Ni Frontier, Ni Prison, which is No Borders, No Prison, the group in so-called Canada that is resisting the proposed construction of a new migrant prison in Laval, a town just outside of Montreal. This is a transcript of the original audio read for the show by Greer. Shout out to him. In this interview, we talk about the prison and what it would mean for people who'd be most affected by it, the general rise of far-right sentiment in so-called Canada, and many other things. The interviewee names the place they are based as Occupied Jojage, which is the original indigenous name for so-called Montreal, which is the colonizer name. The naming of indigenous land will continue throughout the interview with various locations in the name of decolonization, though Jojage is the one which will be the most prominent. As an audio note to all those paying attention, a fridge turns on midway through the interview, then turns back off nearing the end. We've tried to minimize the background noise, but it's still somewhat noticeable.
Then an interview with Robert Free, a long-term Seattle, Washington resident, and Teowa Native American. We will here discuss the history of the Daybreak Star Indian Cultural Center, a cultural and resource center for urban Native Americans in Seattle and the surrounding communities. The Daybreak Star Indian Cultural Center was established after a series of protests and occupations in 1970 of Fort Lawton, an army base that had previously occupied the park. Robert Free discusses the influencing factors of that time, some of the finer points of the occupations, as well as implications of protest and occupation on stolen native land. And some of the names and events mentioned in this chat may be recognizable to you from our February 17th, 2019 episode of The Final Straw, when we had the pleasure to speak with Paulette DeToy about the case of long-term American Indian Movement activist Leonard Peltier. Leonard participated in some of these very same actions as Robert Free. More info on Peltier's case can be found at whoisleonardpeltier.info.
This is from the support website of Masonique Saunders. Quote, on December 7th, 2018, Columbus police murdered 16-year-old Julius Irvin Tate, Jr. On December 13th, they arrested his 16-year-old girlfriend, Masonique Saunders, charging her with the murder they committed. Masonique is being charged with aggravated robbery and felony murder, and is currently being held in juvenile detention. The police have alleged that Julius attempted to rob and pulled a gun on a police officer, and that Masonique was involved in said robbery. Felony murder means that if you commit a felony and someone dies as a result of that crime, you can be charged with their murder. We believe that these charges are unjust and demand the freedom of this 16-year-old black girl and justice for the family of Julius Tate. To help Masonique and her family, donate to her GoFundMe, gofundme.com/free-masonique-legal-fees, and you can donate to the Tate family at gofundme.com/justice-for-Julius, the number 4. End quote. You can visit Masonique Saunders' support website, where there is information, background, and more ways to get involved at freemasonique.home.blog, and her name is spelled M-A-S-O-N-I-Q-U-E.
Stay tuned to the end of this episode for some announcements and updates. The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
Ever since I arrived here at the Super Duper Max, I've been binge-watching the AMC series Walking Dead. I got hooked on it at Mansfield, where I watched the first 6 seasons, but haven't been able to pick back up on it until arriving here, where they have an entertainment channel that plays current movies and other stuff. As fate will have it, they've been playing the series from right where I left off, showing 7 hours of The Walking Dead each evening between 5 p.m. and 11 p.m. Hey, don't you judge me. For anyone not familiar, the show depicts a group of survivors struggling through the zombie apocalypse. This group has evolved over time, particularly the central character and pseudo-leader of the group, Rick Grimes. They've had to deal not only with zombies, which are everywhere, but have had to deal with the stresses and strains of human relationships within the group and deal with other groups of humans, some of whom are ostensibly friendly and cooperative, and others who are downright confrontational. In season 6 and 7, the group found itself in a relatively secure settlement called Alexandria, with steel walls to separate them from the precarious world of the zombies, only to come into direct conflict with a group calling itself the Saviors. The Saviors were led by a ruthless psychopath named Negan, who wields a barbed wire-wrapped baseball bat. Negan's Saviors had superior numbers and guns and soon forced Rick's group to surrender to the Saviors' rule. The Saviors soon took all of their guns and regularly came into their community to take half of everything they owned. In the course of these visits, Negan would regularly kill anyone who offended him, and he would demand that the entire community kneel. Rick and his crew accepted this tyranny, rationalizing that the terror of Negan was favorable compared to the alternative. They simply didn't want to see more of their own get wantonly slaughtered. So they submitted with their chins against their chests and took the abuse that Negan and his saviors unleashed on them. As I'm watching this, I find myself wondering if the writers of The Walking Dead have created a deliberate analogy, or if perhaps I'm just reading something into this that the writers didn't deliberately intend. Either way, I see a fascinating analogy. What Rick and his group are experiencing is the compromise that gets thrust onto all of us. Negan is government. In fact, All through the show, Negan argues repeatedly that he and his armed saviors are the harbingers of civilization. Negan is a big fan of civilization and expects his kneeling subjects to thank him as he parades around them with his barbed wire-wrapped baseball bat. Negan and the saviors collect taxes. They invade other communities. They impose laws and external rule. They disarm their subjects, and they sometimes eliminate those who seem to be bucking the system. Rick and his group within the Alexandria community suffer humiliation and robbery, physical abuse and terror, and they do so under the reasoning that they have no choice, that what they accept passively is better than the alternative. But in short order, some within the community come to conclude that submission is not better than the alternative, that the worst-case scenario would be to end up under the rule of another Negan, that even death is preferable to oppression. That really is an easy conclusion to draw, you know. Famous dead guys in the American Revolution could easily say, give me liberty or give me death, because really, unfreedom, unliberty, is worse than death. So at any rate, a few of Rick's people, independent of one another, each hatch plots to kill Negan. A couple of them try to carry out assassinations of Negan that fail, leading to Negan ruthlessly taking out reprisals on the entire community and further provoking all of them to consider resistance. This seems very accurate to real life to me as well, as in my own experience, I would suggest that oppression breeds resistance. It breeds resistance and is oblivious to its own blunders. It cannot conceive of itself as oppression. It really feels puzzled by the fact that its subjects, its victims, are not grateful for the services that the government provides. Just as Negan seems surprised that Rick and his crew are not appreciative of the brand of civilization that Negan and his saviors have brought. In the last episode I watched, Rick's group was going to other small communities in an effort to enlist them to fight back against Negan, uniting all of the small communities that Negan and the Saviors exploit. It reminds me of Tecumseh uniting tribes to oppose the colonizer in Ohio, or Crazy Horse uniting tribes to make a stand in the Dakotas, or Geronimo gathering the Southwest tribes in one last guerrilla war. It reminds me of the recent pipeline resistance in the Dakotas that brought indigenous tribes and anarchists and even Iraq war vets together. I don't know how this ends yet. I haven't seen how the plotline resolves. But I know how our own plotline, yours and mine, ought to resolve. I know how we ought to be responding to the real-life Negans, to the tyranny imposed on all of us. Compromising freedom, real freedom, is never the right answer. Negan and all of his incarnations must die. Well, I gotta go. It's time for zombies. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the Super Duper Max in Youngstown, Ohio. If you're surviving this zombie apocalypse, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new/old address at Sean Swain, number 243-205, Ohio State Penitentiary, 878 Coitsville Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read more of Sean's writings and keep up on his case, visit seanswain.org.
First of all, thank you so much for your time and coming onto this radio show. Could you first talk about what is attempting to be planned on the part of the Canadian state in terms of this migrant prison in Laval?
Yeah, so the proposed new migrant prison is actually one of a plan that the Canadian government just announced just over 2 years ago now. It's called the National Immigration Detention Framework, and the plan came in response to a period of sustained resistance against the government's practice of incarcerating migrants, many in provincial jails. And for years, going back to 2011, migrants held by the CBSA, which is the Canada Border Services Agency, has been going on periodic hunger strikes in facilities across Ontario. And in the months before the government's announcement of this plan, a new hunger strike was initiated, and there were mobilizations across the country in solidarity. there was a lot of pressure on the government to do something, especially because several migrants had died in CBSA custody over the same period. And so the government responds to all this by announcing a new $138 million plan, but instead of ceding to the demands of the hunger strikers, most of the money ends up being dedicated to building two new migrant prisons, one in Surrey, BC, replacing CBSA's Vancouver Airport facility, and one in Laval, replacing the current one just across the street. So strengthening the detention center that the hunger strikers were fighting against. Many detained migrants in Ontario actually went back on hunger strike following the announcement, but the government just ignored them.
Damn. Is there anything more to say about the like sustained period of resistance on the part of people who were in custody and people maybe who weren't in custody?
Because it's been so long now, I feel like I hesitate to talk more in depth about it because I'm worried I'll get something wrong.
That's totally fine. So you talked a little bit about like how it got started. In what ways have people already been resisting the prison?
Right. So in 2017, the government hired two architecture firms, one called Lamas, one called Group A, to design the new prison. And Solidarity Across Borders, which is a migrant justice network that's been based here in occupied Jajage for over 15 years now, was one of the first groups to talk publicly about this, which brought the project to a lot of people's attention, including myself. And the resistance since has been focused on companies working on the project. Last year, an anonymous group released crickets into Lamas' headquarters. That was great. A nice biblical flourish.
I heard about that. Yeah.
And last month, the group I'm a part of, Ni Frontier Ni Prison, organized a demonstration against Lamas that ended at their headquarters. Since then, a company that remediated the soil at the proposed construction site has had their offices spray painted. And just a few weeks ago, a group of about 30 people barricaded the road leading to what was called the, quote, site visit, end quote, for companies who wanted to bid on the contract to build the prison. So that's a bit of an overview of what's been happening. Ni Frontier Ni Prison, which I'm a part of, is focused more on organizing public actions and events, which are just one part of the struggle against the construction of the prison, which includes a diversity of tactics and multiple groups.
Sick. Does the group work in coalition with, like, other groups that are fighting the prison or, like, people that are detained in the prison?
So there's no formal coalition, but there is dialogue and discussion between other groups who are also doing work against a specific prison, but also against migrant detention more generally, working for status for all against the border. And so Solidarity Across Borders is a group that includes many people without status, many people who have been through the current migrant detention center and who have been doing that work for a very long time.
So I would really love to get a sense of, and maybe listeners already know these things based on their own experiences, but what would this prison mean for those people who would be most directly affected by it?
Right. So the first thing I should say is that the migrant detention is central to Canada's ability to deport people. And the CBSA has made a commitment recently to start increasing deportations by about 30%. So this prison represents an investment in both the continued violence of deportation as well as detention. But in practical terms, strengthening that threat of violence means that it'll come to be almost impossible to seek services here or to resist exploitation. It maintains them as a source of precarious and exploitable labor. But I mean, the violence of the migrant prison itself can't be understated. People are often in prison in these facilities for years without charge. People die in these facilities, and I believe very strongly that prisons aren't the answer to the challenges we face in our communities. Locking people up, limiting people's movement, deporting people to dangerous situations or possible death, all of these things only cause more violence and harm. Speaking for myself, I want to live in a world without prisons and without borders where people actually have the things they need to live their lives with dignity and respect.
Definitely. And yeah, that's been my understanding too. I mean, in the US as well, like prisons are a huge source of capitalistic gain and, you know, a source of like precarious and exploitable labor, like you mentioned. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense, just like for me coming from a US context. So, at the radio show, we've been hearing about this prison couched in terms of humanity, like it would be a so-called more humane detention center. And you mentioned that it was being built, like, right across the street or right next to a detention center that already exists. Would you talk about why the Canadian state is attempting this branding right now?
Yeah. So the government has been marketing this entire project as creating a more humane approach to incarcerating migrants. But it's just an attempt to change the subject from the question of why the government is putting migrants in prison to begin with, something a lot of people started asking following the hunger strikes. And if you look at the designs that the architects put together, it makes it really clear what's actually going on. Like, the plans talk about how all the fencing around the prison needs to be covered by foliage to limit what it calls, quote, the harshness of the look, or that the iron bars over the windows have to be as inconspicuous as possible to the outside public, and that the children's area needs to be bordered by what they call a 6-foot-high visual barrier to make sure no one outside can see the imprisoned children. So essentially, it's just a new prison with a nicer-looking face. And if you're being separated from your family, your community, awaiting deportation to possible torture or death, I highly doubt you're going to be too concerned with how sustainable the concrete is or what color the ceilings are in the prison you're being held in. But another element of this plan is something that the government is marketing as, quote, alternatives to detention. I mean, these programs only make up something like 3% of the total budget of the plan, but it's been a central part of its marketing as a more humane approach than the previous government. These alternatives, they include forcing migrants to wear electronic ankle bracelets so that their movements can be tracked. There's this collaboration with the John Howard Society to force migrants into their halfway homes. They've also created this GPS phone reporting system that forces migrants to make regular check-in calls that test their voice prints. And so these are all ways that the government is actually expanding its capacity for surveillance and control of migrants outside of its prisons. You know, before the only option was detaining or releasing people, but now they're expanding their reach. And there was actually a renewed hunger strike by incarcerated migrants when these alternatives were launched last year. But again, the government just ignored them.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming that the halfway house that you mentioned, as well as the ankle bracelets, are those a for-profit endeavor?
So yeah, the halfway houses, the John Howard Society, got a multi-million dollar contract to oversee that project. I'm not sure offhand what the company is that's overseeing the ankle bracelets, but the technology was actually engineered as a part of the post 9/11 National Security Certificate program here, which involved imprisoning non-citizens indefinitely without charge on secret evidence. Mostly it was Arab and Muslim men. And some of these men who were caught up in the system in the early 2000s, they actually requested to be transferred back to prison rather than continuing to live with those ankle monitors because of how intense and repressive that system really was. But it's really clear with these alternatives that all these carceral technologies that have been used in these post 9/11 sort of state of exception moments, but also through the federal prison system, are leaking in and bleeding into the system of how Canada relates to migrant populations.
It's like bringing the prison into the home is kind of my experience of how ankle monitors generally work. Yeah, and I think the whole, like, it, I'm really, like, bothered by this entire thing, but also this sort of softer, gentler prison where you can't really see the kids, and the harshness of the prison is dulled by, like, some kind of fake foliage. Like, it's a... The quality of the Canadian state is something that I'm not really all that informed about, but what I have been informed of, it's like just extraordinarily toxic neoliberal co-optation of like diversity and understanding when it in fact is like a genocidal machine. I've been listening to a lot of From Embers, so I've been like, this fucking Canadian state is a fucking hellscape. But yeah, thank you for going into that, the ankle bracelets and the for-profit nature of the John Howard Society. So speaking of the state, I think that people all over the world have been noting the increasingly frenetic attention that governments are paying to borders, with similarly increasingly racist rhetoric applied to many people seeking safety in places like so-called Canada, so-called US and UK. Are there things to keep in mind about this proposed detention center in this current, like, polarizing climate?
Right. So over the past few years in Quebec, we've seen the rise of far-right anti-immigrant groups that have actually achieved a level of mass support here that I think is unique compared to the rest of the country. And this is for a lot of reasons. An important one on substantially reducing immigration to Quebec, and then is also introducing values and language tests for new migrants, which they've begun to put in place. And so this more, I guess, local far-right upsurge in anti-immigrant sentiment is increasingly bolstering support here for the federal government's deportation regime. I think this makes it an important moment to intervene to help disrupt that, because I think that fighting back against the rise of the sentiment needs to be more than a one-pronged fight against the far-right groups on the ground. I really think that the struggle also needs to be connected to sustained resistance towards racist structures that predate these groups. These structures often share a vision with these newer far-right groups, but I think there may be more fundamental parts of our colonial context here.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm wondering if you wouldn't say more about if you know anything more or like are comfortable saying anything more about the structures, like fighting against the structures that predate the current governmental climate or political climate that's happening right now. What would you think would be involved in that?
Oh, well, I think that a migration policy is a great example of this, where so much of the focus, that conversation around the country and in Quebec right now, is so focused around people crossing the border from the United States on foot into Canada, and talking about the influx of refugees who are crossing into Canada or applying for refugee status here, many of which are being denied. But the entire apparatus of detention and deportation completely predates this. It's in fact not linked to this upsurge in migration. It's linked to the temporization of status for people here, which has been going back for decades. And if we're only looking at what's directly in front of us, we're not going to understand or be able to effectively confront these structures that are much more deeply rooted in the fabric of the Canadian state and in Canadian history. Mm.
Yes, thank you very much for bringing up that point. This is The Final Straw, a weekly anti-authoritarian anarchist radio show broadcasting from occupied Cherokee land. And I'm your host, William. We're speaking with someone from the Montreal-based group Ni Frontière, Ni Prison, which is No Borders, No Prison, about opposition to a proposed new migrant prison just outside of so-called Montreal. Now we will talk about how the Canadian and U.S. states use the concept of citizenship to oppress migrants and refugees. I think that goes really well into the next question, which is, would you talk about how the concept of citizenship is being weaponized by the state in this case, but also has always sort of been weaponized by the state?
Yeah, I mean, the concept of citizenship has always been based on exclusion, and the Canadian context is no different. Things like the Chinese head tax, the Kamigata Maru incident, the none is too many policy towards Jewish refugees fleeing the Holocaust. The Canadian state's approach to immigration has always been shaped by its white supremacist foundations. And actually, with the exception of the British Commonwealth countries, Canada has had an official whites-only immigration policy until the 60s. But the 1960s government, like I was saying, it's been increasingly temporizing the status of people coming here. It's gotten to the point where now over two-thirds of people who are granted status to live and work here each year are getting some form of temporary status. And so the CBSA's migration detention and deportation apparatus was built to enforce this. It was a necessary byproduct of these changes. And that system is a part of maintaining the flow of wealth from the global south to the global north. Workers from the global south come here, have their labor exploited at extreme levels, put huge sums of money into the Canadian economy, and then they're kicked out. And Canada doesn't just benefit from this, but it actively participates in impoverishing and displacing people in the global south who then end up on their doorstep.
Definitely. I feel like there's a lot to talk about there, but I think that you gave a really good summary. And I think that I would really love to talk about move on to some other questions which have to do with the more positive aspects of the resistance to this thing. So we in the States are familiar with the concept of a sanctuary city, which indicates that a place limits their cooperation with the national government to follow through on deportations in many ways. But I came across the term solidarity city in articles on your website. Would you talk about the distinction between the two and what is meant by a solidarity city?
Oh, sure. So this is actually a framing that comes out of the work of Solidarity Across Borders. Sanctuary city campaigns, they tend to be focused on asking the municipal government to protect people without status. But for years now, Solidarity Across Borders has put forward the analysis that we should be creating our own networks of mutual aid and solidarity. And as a good example for this is the police. You know, at least here, the police are one of the biggest problems that undocumented migrants face. And that problem doesn't go away with city officials signing a sanctuary city declaration. The last mayor here actually announced that Montreal was a sanctuary city, but nothing changed. The police continue to collaborate with the CBESA to detain and deport people. But a solidarity city is different because it's something that's built from the ground up through building networks of resistance and non-cooperation with these agencies that enforce deportations and detentions, not by appealing to power.
Yeah, I think that building from the ground up while at the same time refusing cooperation is, I think, a really, like, it's sparking something in my head. So yeah, thanks for talking about that.
Yeah, no problem. You can check out more at Solidarity Across Borders website, which is solidarityacrossborders.org/EN for English.
Cool. I'll link that in the show notes. So would you speak about this struggle in terms of decolonization? What are some parallels that you can locate between decolonization and a project that has a more anti-border ethic?
Right. So the most influential border around us here in occupied Jajage is the American border, which is very close by. And about 2 hours east of us here is Akwesasne, which is Kanagahage territory. This territory additionally is recognized as a federal reserve. Jajage is also Kanagahage territory, but isn't federally recognized as such. Akwesasne itself is actually cut into two by that border, and there's been conflict for decades between the CBSA, who attempt to enforce that border, and indigenous people who refuse to acknowledge their authority on their territory. So anyway, all this is to say that it's very clear here that the way the borders around us are fairly recent colonial constructions. But since we're talking about prisons, in Canada, incarceration as a practice was largely spread as a part of the ongoing genocide against Indigenous peoples as a tool of assimilation. And today, when you look at who's inside Canadian prisons, Indigenous people are disproportionately represented. And so the same colonial and capitalist forces that are creating war, poverty, destruction throughout the global South are continuing to oversee the genocide and dispossession of Indigenous peoples here in the global North. Many people being displaced and arriving to this territory are indigenous to different areas on this continent, and many of them are ending up in these migrant prisons. But over the last decade or so here, different migrant justice formations have gone through processes of dialogue and discussion with the indigenous groups, which has led to some changes in messaging and overlook over time. And I mean, we've been influenced by this too, but as settlers, we have a lot more work to do on this front, I think.
Definitely. Did I understand you correctly that Indigenous folks are being incarcerated in these migrant jails?
Well, not folks who are Indigenous to the territories governed by the Canadian state, but people who are Indigenous to, like, other areas on the continent who are then displaced and would not be understood or classified by the Canadian state as their Indigenous identity based on the country of origin.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And many, like, Indigenous territories, like, don't, I mean, the border is a colonial, construct that was, you know, and the Indigenous territories vastly, vastly predate that colonial construct, obviously. How can people support the group that you are speaking from, Ni Frontier, Ni Prison, and could you also, like, brainstorm modes of support that folks can enact who, for whatever reason, are not in a position to do confrontational or legally risky direct action?
Oh yeah, for sure. So this month we actually have a call-in campaign where we're encouraging folks to either call, email, or fax the companies who are currently bidding for the contract to build this new prison. So we highly encourage anyone who would like to do this. You can go on our Facebook page, facebook.com/nifrontier/niprison, and you'll see the information about the call-in campaign there. But in terms of non-risky ways to participate in a struggle like this, the group I'm a part of, we do public actions, and the demonstrations we've organized so far have been very low risk, very family-friendly, to quote maybe an outdated activist parlance. We've been helping organize information sessions in neighborhoods across the city in partnership with different groups. Artists have contributed a series of posters, which people have been helping put up across the city. People have made videos about the struggle against the prison, written articles. There's lots of ways that people have contributed and continue to and to participate in this that isn't particularly high risk. Particularly right now, we could actually use some help spreading word about the struggle and why we're in opposition to the prison.
I wonder if you have any words about the importance of the call-in campaign, because I think that many, at least many anarchists that I know, are like a little bit hesitant to do call-in campaigns. Would you talk about the importance of that tactic?
I mean, I can talk about it in context to our strategy here. We decided to focus on the call-in campaign after an action that happened disrupting a site visit to the CBSA organized to talk with the people who were interested in bidding on the contract to build the prison. And so people went there and disrupted it, and there were a lot of conversations with workers from the companies who had been sent there to talk with the CBSA about the contract. And some of those conversations went really well. What we're trying to do in this phase before the general contractor is chosen to build the prison is to let all the companies know who are considering doing this work that there will be resistance if they decide to take that contract. To let them know it may be in their financial best interest to walk away from this project. And that strategy will continue depending on what company is chosen, but obviously the tactics will shift.
I'm also really interested in hearing any words that you have about like the nature of the tactic of a call-in campaign. So like maybe this is a little bit of a like circular or esoteric question, but I'm wanting to like provide people with some sort of way to mentally grasp on to what is being like achieved here and what is being proposed and like what the goals are generally of like something like that. Is it just annoyance or?
Well, there are multiple reasons for it. Like on one side of it, there's the effect of heightening the contradictions that actually already exist within some of these companies in relationships to projects like this, of creating a sense of wariness on the part of the companies about embarking, but it also gives way for organizations and individuals to engage with the struggle at the phase it's at right now.
It makes sense that it would be like, you know, it is a safer, in scare quotes, way to, you know, participate in like showing dissent.
Yeah, and also we can't rely on mainstream corporate media to relay a message to these companies that there is a widespread opposition to the practice of incarcerating migrants. Like, we need to do that ourselves. And what that looks like is actually going and disrupting their events and their meetings and showing up at their workplaces. But it also means calling them incessantly and sending them endless faxes with lots of black ink to let them know that this is the wrong move for them. And if they make it, things like this will probably increase. And that's generally the thinking behind it.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So those are all the questions that I had. Thank you again for your time. Is there anything that you'd like to add in this interview or words that you'd leave listeners with?
The only thing I haven't mentioned is at the end of this month, the government is scheduled to make a decision about which company they're going to give the contract to build the new prison. And depending on who that is, I'm sure there will be actions coming up. If you want to keep up on what's happening with the struggle, you can go to stopponslaprison.info. It's a clearinghouse for information about the construction of the prison as well as resistance to it. Or you can follow us on Facebook and you can send us an email at nifrontier/niprison@riseup.net if you want to get involved.
Is there anything that we missed that you wanted to sort of give more voice to or present here?
No, I think we covered it. Thanks so much for the time and for taking an interest in this struggle.
That was our interview with someone from the group Ni Frontier Ni Prison, transcribed by us and re-recorded by Greer to preserve the person's anonymity. To get in touch with this group, you can email them at nifrontierniprison@riseup.net. And for updates and further ways to get involved, you can find them at facebook.com/nifrontierniprison. To get hyperlinks to those things, plus further links to the Kamigata Maru incident, the Chinese head tax, and the none is too many policy, events that our guest mentioned. You can visit the show notes at our website, thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. And you can email us if you would like a zine copy of the transcript to this show at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.
On the morning of March 8th, 1970, a situation of civil unrest erupted in Seattle's Magnolia neighborhood. Native Americans from a wide array of different tribes and their allies descended upon Fort Lawton, an active military base on what is now known as Discovery Park. What began was a series of campouts, break-ins, and protests to stake a claim on land that the city of Seattle was looking to repurpose as Fort Lawton was facing imminent closure. Nearly 50 years later, the Daybreak Star Indian Cultural Center stands today on 16 acres within the park, nestled between the Magnolia neighborhood and the Puget Sound, atop towering cliffs that offer a spectacular view of migrating southern resident orca whales, if you're lucky. Built in 1977, the Daybreak Star Indian Cultural Center is a land base and community center for Native Americans in the Seattle area. But this historic moment did not happen in a vacuum. Puget Sound had played host to the Fish Wars the prior decade, and the takeover at Alcatraz Island by the Indians of all tribes happened only months previously. The Fish Wars were a series of protests, civil disobedience and direct actions in the Nisqually and Tacoma area in the 1960s. As the white settler populations in the area began to grow, the numbers of fishermen in the area grew as well, and competition for the huge numbers of salmon in the area that the rivers had become famous for increased. As the salmon population dwindled due to overfishing practices conducted by white fishermen in offshore boats, anger and frustration about the declining salmon was directed at Native Americans, despite their more sustainable fishing practices. Native Americans experienced violent reprisal at the hands of fishermen and police alike, until the federal government sued the state of Washington for violation of the treaties, resulting in the famous Bolt Decision of 1974, which secured fishing rights for Native Americans. The takeover of Alcatraz Island on November 20, 1969, in the San Francisco Bay Area was not the beginning of a movement for Native American sovereignty, but rather a moment that grabbed national attention and forced American society to contend with the issues facing the indigenous community at large. Alcatraz had at one time been a federal penitentiary, and as a decommissioned piece of federal land, was supposed to be given back to the Native American tribe whose land it sat on. A pan-tribal group of Native Americans had taken boats out to the island and seized it, unfurling banners, building kitchens, a radio station, and much more as they settled in to let the world know that they were ready to take action in a very public manner. In an effort to illuminate this powerful moment in decolonizing the coastlines of the Salish Sea, I was lucky enough to sit down with Seattle resident Robert Free, a veteran of the Fish Wars, the Alcatraz Island occupation, the Fort Lawton takeovers, just to name a few. We sat down in the Beacon Hill Library and had a chat.
Well, my name is Robert Free. I'm part Tarawa, part Nahua, and I did a blood thing. What do they call that? A DNA ancestry.
Right,
yeah. Yeah, and I had like 54% Native from down in Mexico area, 22 Spanish, or Iberian they call it, 19% French, and then a bunch of little things from like Russia, or I don't know, little things like 1%, 1%, 1%. It was really something. So anyways, I own it all, and but my heart and spirit there is indigenous more so than these other things.
So in the 1960s and 1970s, there were a lot of radical groups organizing to liberate oppressed peoples across the world. In the United States, you had the Black Panthers, you had the American Indian Movement, you had the Brown Berets, you had Students for Democratic Society, you had people organizing against the Vietnam War, for civil rights, against poverty. It was kind of a pretty widespread thing that was happening. I just wanted to ask you, what was it like to be part of such a massive wave of political protest at that time?
Well, when you say at that time, and you just mentioned the 60s and 70s, it grabs your attention because why? And you know, you got to think that there's been struggle way before those days. There's been great repression before those days. And at least for this part of the world, it's been going on for 500 years. And the resistance has been going on for that long. So to narrow it down to the excitement of the 60s, and the reason it became a memorable thing is because it affected white people. White people were being drafted and suddenly became conscious of their potential to die, and they didn't want to. So you got to think of it in that context.
Do you feel like in the late 60s, as like the rest of American society was like forced to grapple with these questions, do you feel like there was a shift?
I think there was, by the black folks going for civil rights, created a consciousness that people either woke up to or not. And that caused people to question. If they saw the news of people getting beat up and tear gas and dogs biting them and getting spat on when they try to sit down to eat at a counter, or if they went to go organize to vote, or if you, of course, have the children trying to go to school, you have to have military. That broke the picture of what they thought their perfect country was all about. And young people are more pliable, if that's the word, to see a contrast. White folks say that's the way it should be. You've got to have it like this. Sure got it. Glad the police are there doing, beating them up and everything. Look at them patriots get up there and show them how it should be. Kind of like where we're at now with Make America Great Again. That's the remnants of that era. Went into hiding, went back in the butcher holler, and there they are. The base for a Nazi person like Trump and his supporters. Yeah, those things were happening. You know, there was that, and then the young folks, music was enticing them to think differently, to go against. The cars came into being, so everybody went to drive-ins and had sex and drank there. So there's a lot of liberating things. And same with drugs, psychedelic drugs were causing people to break down mental, psychic prisons. Be challenged to think of something different. So all those factors being there set the foundation for a resistance to what was just a continual glacial oppressive virus on the planet in the United States.
I think that people nowadays in the information age, everything is, you can just learn about it, figure out about it in the blink of an eye. And I think that people really,
there's no retention. People think they are learning by going on the internet and being bombarded with stuff. Ask them the next day what about anything, and they don't remember. They're on to the next little flash.
I think that a lot of people nowadays take it for granted.
It's objective. It's not. They're not in Africa starving. They're not being beat up by Ukraine's in the war. You know, they're not there. But, you know, it's media coverage, you know. And they get saturated so much and so knowledgeable about all that, you become numb to it, really. And they actually don't do nothing. A lot of people, even in this country, oh, look at Trump, but they don't do nothing.
Talking about more specifically in the Seattle area, like what was happening that kind of accelerated these protests at the Fort Lawton?
Well, first of all, we was talking about the 60s and 70s. And I tried to say that it was way before that. And the issues of the people being repressed after they repressed a native people were blacks, browns, you know, all these other folks and all their other issues that they've got. But they've always wanted to be part, most of them wanted to be part of the American pie. Give me some of that pie. Indians basically says, you go your way, we'll go ours, and we'll be friends. But they wanted it. And they said, sure, temporarily, until they can get in a better military position to just take what they want. So that's been the native resistance, indigenous resistance, is that oppression and taking of lands. Whereas all the other folks afterwards, it's not for that. It's to be part of the high moral ideals of a country that says, hey, let's all head for these utopian ideals of liberty, freedom for all. Oh, but let's forget that we're doing it on top of somebody else, basically. And eradicating all that information, that history, has made it harder for that resistance that's been nonstop to be seen and understood by those who are indigenous. So being that all that is happening, and in the 70s, natives again just got up and were able to have a better arena to come up and try to assert sovereignty, self-determination, address those things. The other groups aren't asking for sovereignty and self-determination. Self-determination maybe to have opportunities to self-determine with the other folks that have opportunity. There's a bit difference. So all that was happening. But protest politics, all the isms, we've always had to confront them folks who want us right off the bat, before they even listen to us, to do solidarity with them, to acknowledge them. And they won't join and support us alongside us or behind us. They'll try to get in front of us, or they try to bring all their other issues in front of us. That has been half our battle.
I wanted to ask you if there were any parallels that you might see between then being 1969, 1970 in Seattle or on the West Coast and now recent contemporary struggles that you've been following.
Well, the apparatus is the same, west, center of the country, east. So I don't like to isolate just the west. I mean, if you want to react to what was the response in this area to that whole conglomeration of oppression, we can go there. But just to give you an example, I was just thinking the other day, and I was in contact with some old friends from the Four Corners area, the Dene people. And I remember when we were on Alcatraz Island in 1970 about, and I'll bring it to Fort Lawton too. When we took over Alcatraz Island, which the 50th anniversary is coming up this November, we became kind of like a sanctuary for warrior people that wanted to change something, self-determination and sovereignty effort. And we would get asked to come up and support groups. And one of those groups, I'll get to the Four Corners later, but one of the groups was from this area. The fishing right people who had been fighting before the takeover of Alcatraz, like other Six Nations people fighting, you know, all kinds of people fighting and not getting any publicity. Taking over Alcatraz gave it a focal point and spotlight to people to pinpoint relate everything else from there. Oh yeah, you're going here like Alcatraz, which is, what are you guys there for, why? And so it started dialogue. It was a place, you had a microphone you could on the island and articulate on our own time, our own schedule. And so native people would come to this beacon, discuss their problems, learn about Alcatraz, learn about other issues, rediscovering their own identity, their own spirituality. It was that kind of a place. The people that were doing fishing rights struggles came down to visit. And they brought news that the Fort Lawton up here, military base, was going to be decommissioned and be declared surplus. And the bases of taking over Alcatraz was surplus land supposed to be returned to native people. And so they said, could you guys come and help us up there? And Richard Oakes, who had recently swam to Alcatraz Island, said, yeah. And he organized a caravan of Indians to come up here and help support the Franks Landing Indians to take the land over for the Duwamish tribe, to return it to the Duwamish tribe. They were unrecognized tribe here. And so we came up here, and with a lot of supporters, there's over 100 of us. A majority of them were from Alcatraz Island, and some had weapons, some, and we went there and helped take it over. And from Fort Lawton, you know, the whole details of the takeover, you know, going over by a cliff in Magnolia to somebody's backyard and falling the cliff over on a full 600 military alert was there. We They were at all the gates around, but never watched their back on the cliffs. They figured, oh, nobody's going to come on those cliffs. But we did, and then that's how we got in there, and then Rhett kicked the teepee in there. And, and then eventually we were removed forcibly by, hundreds of those military police, and everybody running and escaping, and a bunch did not and got beat up inside the barracks. Sid Mills especially was fighting there. And so we were evicted and given court papers to come in for these charges. But not me and my other buddy. We jumped off a cliff and went back that way when we were being chased. There we were, early morning. The military find out that there's 100 Indians in the middle of Fort Lawton. After we had, and it was kind of cold and foggy in the morning over by the cliffs, and we snuck in, even had a little old lady, maybe 67 years old, Ella Aquino, and other folks, a lot of kids too. Anyways, we went in there, and as I can remember it, we started to survey the where we were. Where we were vulnerable to get captured or attacked. And you could see the military slowly surrounding us, slowly coming closer and closer and closer. At some point, people refused to move, and then that's when they tried to capture people and arrest them. And that's when everybody took off in all directions. And myself and Robert George from the Suquamish, we were being chased by jeeps, guys on jeeps, and guys running after us. And we would dodge them, but we're on this huge field. The field's still there over at Fort Lawton Discovery Park there. And we would run and run, and finally we got to the point where we must have been running for about 20 minutes of running at full speed. Almost getting captured by a jeep, and the guy's arms would reach out, and we'd duck and then run, and these other guys, a couple of them had like rifles, they were like, and batons, trying to capture us, intimidating us, but we'd outrun them. And finally we got so tired, there was that opening to the cliff, there was no fences or nothing. And we thought, looked at each other, said, what the heck? And we just ran, and we flew off the cliff, and down the cliff was, it's still like that right now. I went over there and seen it. It's just sand and berry bushes. And we went flying down the side of the cliff there into berry bushes, getting tore up, tumbling through the berry bushes till about 3 or 4 tumbles through the berry bush, that they slow you down enough on your clothes and your face and hands. And we just stood there like a scarecrow's trapped, in the middle of these berry bushes, kind of bleeding. And we looked up, and all these military MPs were standing up there just going, admiring our bravery, I think, or stupidity, they don't know. But they weren't going to follow us. So we made our way down and got out of there. The other folks, I heard they were beaten up in the barracks there, the holding cells. Because some of the guys like Sid Mills were just straight out of the military. They just come back from Vietnam, had Purple Hearts, had their bodies blown up a bit. And they called them out. You wimp. To the who's a head guy here? Some captain came in there and called him out. Another lieutenant, and then they start taking their helmets off and putting their stuff away, and they jumped inside the cell and they all went at it. So that's kind of what happened. And eventually they got released, bailed out, and so we set up a camp around all the perimeter, and just had signs, and we're staying in tents in the rain and everything for a couple weeks. And so that gave a lot of publicity to this Northwest area, doing action like that, ready to take on 500 military police. Not intimidated.
One, two, three.
Esto es únicamente una prueba. Uno, dos, uno, dos.
In Montreal.
CKUT. All the rhythms, all the music, all the time.
90.3 FM.
Cinema Politica is thrilled to announce a special screening of the program Queer for Palestine on November 15 at 7 p.m. at La Sala Rossa. From intimate portrayal to experimental cinema, this program of queer shorts from Palestine and Lebanon examines the intersection of gender and sexual identity with the Palestinian liberation struggle. Co-curated with programmers from Regard Palestinia and co-presented with the Feminist Media Studio and the Palestinian Youth Movement, the event is part of Queer Cinema for Palestine, the first ever 10-day film festival.
I'm at CKUT in Montreal, 90.3 FM. Keep on rocking in the free world.
Attention McGill undergraduate students, referendum is upon us. Exercise your right to vote on questions that matter to you and your campus experience. Vote in the fall referendum period from Monday, November 8th to Friday, November 12th. Look for your ballot in your McGill student email between November 8th to 12th. Let's rock the vote.
Le virus de la COVID-19 et ses variants se propagent toujours au Québec. En cas de symptômes d'allure grippale ou s'apparentant à ceux de la COVID-19, tels que la fièvre, la toux ou la perte du goût ou de l'odorat, ou si vous avez été en contact avec une personne infectée par le virus, il est essentiel de passer un test de dépistage et de respecter les consignes d'isolement, même si vous êtes vacciné. Le dépistage demeure un des meilleurs moyens de limiter les éclosions. Pour en savoir plus, visitez québec.ca/test COVID-19